Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. There was a stunning decision this morning to award President Obama the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to improve international diplomacy. The Senate Finance Committee schedules a key vote on health care legislation. And the House expands its year-long ethics probe into Congressman Charles Rangel. Joining me to discuss these stories and more for this hour of the Friday News Roundup, Gene Cummings of Politico. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
And Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us for the first time on the Friday News Roundup, Michael Fletcher of the Washington Post. Thanks
Hello.
For being with us.
Yeah, good to be here.
We're going to invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, this was a surprise announcement this morning. Let's listen to it for just a moment.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2009 is to be awarded to President Barack Obama for his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples.
Now, the Associated Press reports that there were gasps in the room from the reporters who were covering this announcement. Michael Fletcher, you spend a lot of time at the White House. Was there any expectation or even speculation that President Obama might win?
Well, none at the White House. I mean, his name had kind of surfaced some, but most people dismissed the idea of him winning the prize simply because he'd been in office 12 days before the nomination deadline, you know, closed. So people thought the idea of Barack Obama winning the prize would be something far-fetched. And you could hear it today in the reaction from the White House. They were as surprised as anyone. I remember waking up this morning and looking at my BlackBerry and seeing this and gasping like the people did in Oslo.
We expect President Obama to make some comments on the announcement in sometime during this hour, and we may bring you those words when they happen. Gene Cummings, why did he win?
Well, it really is an intriguing award decision, and you know, most of the analysts that I read this morning and heard seem to think that it's more awarded in an effort to try to encourage other nations to engage again and to encourage the U.S. down this path. Clearly, there's no thing that he has done so far to have merited this award. So it's almost as though this is intended to keep the process going, keep the United States in this direction, get other countries on board, and to sort of buy down on his promise of hope and change.
You know, there's no question it's a high honor, Jerry Seib, to win the Nobel Peace Prize. What do you think it means for President Obama? Do you think that it is a total political plus for him, or is there possibly maybe a mixed meaning for him in this award?
It's definitely a political plus. I wouldn't say it's a total political plus because it's being met already with some level of derision on the right among conservatives and will increase the sense that this is a guy more beloved by Europeans than people in the middle of America. But I think in the end, you have to say that Americans probably would rather have their president be a Nobel Peace Prize winner than not. And it's a recognition, I think, that the world appreciates perhaps more than Americans do the extent to which just the arrival of Barack Obama has changed the tone of American foreign policy. The notion that we're not unilateralists any longer is a big deal to the rest of the world, even if Americans kind of shrug their shoulders sometimes because they have other things to worry about.
Change the tone perhaps in the world, but the tone of American political politics, American partisanship has apparently not been changed. Michael Steele, the Republican chairman, out with a statement this morning already, a three-sentence statement that takes Obama to task for winning this award. He says the real questions Americans are asking is, what has President Obama actually accomplished? And Michael Steele, the Republican chairman, goes on to say, President Obama won't be receiving any awards from Americans for job creation, fiscal responsibility, or backing up rhetoric with concrete action. What do you think about that, Michael Fletcher, that some Republicans, including the chairman of the party, are right out of the box taking President Obama, really trying to turn this award to criticize him?
Yeah, I find it quite interesting. I mean, clearly, as Jerry points out, it kind of plays into this notion of the president sort of being more potential than sort of deliverable at this point. But the idea that Republicans would criticize this, you heard the same thing when he went to Copenhagen a week ago to try to win the Olympics for Chicago. And when he came back empty-handed, there was a lot of derision there. And even before he went, people were criticizing him, saying he shouldn't go. I think it just speaks to where politics are in this country today, because it seems to me like the smart political move would be to applaud him and just kind of move on. But clearly, there's no room left in kind of our political landscape for that.
You know, Gene Cummings, the White House is now deliberating whether to send additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan, whether to change the course of the 8-year-old war there. And I wonder, while we're going to talk more about Afghanistan in the second hour, the international hour of the News Roundup, could this award be any factor as President Obama considers sending more troops to that war?
Well, I doubt that it will influence the final decision that he makes, because I think he'll make that based upon the deliberations that are going on in the White House with his national security team and his military advisors. I think the influence of this could, though, have an impact in terms of the Middle East and in terms of some of the other, North Korea and Iran and, you know, those conversations that are just starting with those countries after so many years. So I think, you know, it could have some influence in that respect, more so than I think in the decision that he ultimately will make in Afghanistan.
And Jerry, he's just the third sitting U.S. president to win this award. Who are the others?
Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt. And Jimmy Carter won it, I think, something like 20 years after he left the White House. And he won it more for what he did after being president than what he did while being president. So, you know, Roosevelt, Wilson, and Carter is, you know, it's a pretty interesting company to be in. And, you know, I agree. I think the politics of the moment probably would have suggested, you know, congratulating him and moving on for Republicans would be the thing to do. You don't get the sense in the early reaction that's what's going to happen so much.
We have also developments on health care legislation this week. We now, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, says that the Senate Finance Committee will vote finally on its health care measure Tuesday. Developments this week, Gene Cummings, with the release of the Congressional Budget Office score for their bill. What did the CBO find?
Well, the CBO actually delivered a score that Harry Reid could have only hoped for, $850 billion in costs, which was lower than what they expected. It actually, they were shooting for something closer to $900 billion or a little under. I think ultimately that gives them a little growing room when they finally have to negotiate a final bill between the House and the Senate. It also projected big, big savings for the deficit. I believe the number was $81 billion over the course of 10 years. So that's another thing that was one of the goals of this reform effort. So for the chairman, Chairman Baucus, that was a huge victory. It clearly greases the skids for the legislation to move out of his committee. That's a really important hurdle, but it's hardly the last one.
Will it move out of committee with any Republican votes as well as Democratic ones?
We still haven't heard from Senator Snowe of Maine, who is the only Republican who is considering whether to vote for it or not. All of the rest of the Republicans have pretty much staked out positions in opposition, and there appears to be no movement there, despite the fact that another development this week were many Republican leaders outside of Congress coming out and actually endorsing the legislation, Governor Schwarzenegger and former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole.
Jerry Seib, you know, there was an era when $829 billion would not sound like a small, reassuring price tag for a piece of legislation. I think a lot of Americans say, how can you spend $829 billion to expand coverage to more Americans and do some other things with the healthcare system and yet save money on the deficit?
Well, what you have to remember is that the government is the biggest healthcare buyer in the world, the U.S. government is. And if you can construct a healthcare reform that actually in the long run reduces the cost the government has to bear directly to pay for that healthcare system, then you've saved the government money. You haven't saved the country money, but you've saved the government money. And from the Obama administration's point of view, that's really the key here. If you start bringing down the costs for the government, that means the costs of providing healthcare for everybody will eventually be coming down as well. And that's really the goal here. The secondary goal is to say to people, okay, look, the deficit we now know as of this week is 1.5 $1.4 trillion this year. We're not going to make that worse. That's a source of much sticker shock in the country already.
Michael Fletcher, there's been a lot of debate over whether this legislation will include what we call a public option, a government-run option for health care. Does it look like the Senate measure will do that?
No, it doesn't look like we're going to have a public option here, despite big support for this among liberals in the Democratic Party. And there are a lot of divisions among Democrats even about how to pay for this bill as well. So, as Gene says, there are many hurdles remain, and among them is, like, how do you pay for this thing? The Senate version talks about this tax on so-called Cadillac health care plans in the House. House Democrats are a lot cooler to this idea, so we'll see how this plays out going forward.
Jean?
Well, and I think that the public option is certainly not gone yet. I think that fight, to be honest, is just starting, and that's a fight within the Democratic caucus by itself. And we are already hearing talk of potential compromise legislation that would bring a public option in the final bill in as either a trigger or an opt-in or opt-out at the state level. The House is definitely going to have some version of it in its legislation. So I think that the public option tug of war is about to begin in earnest as soon as that bill gets out of the Finance Committee.
You know, this idea of letting states decide themselves whether to have a public option, is that a possible compromise, do you think, Jerry?
It is. Senator Carper from Delaware proposed it this week. It got a little burst of excitement right away as maybe this is the way you thread that needle on the public option. It puts the Congress in the position of pleasing the left to some extent by creating an opening for a public option, but keeping those people in the middle happier by not agreeing to pay for the whole thing itself right at the beginning.
Jerry Seib is executive Washington editor of The Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'll talk about how things look on the economy and whether there'll be more federal action to promote job creation. And we'll go to the phones, take your calls, read your emails, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on the air on Monday. With me in the studio, Michael Fletcher. He's White House correspondent for The Washington Post, Jerry Seib with The Wall Street Journal, and Jean Cummings. She is assistant managing editor in charge of enterprise at Politico. You know, we started the hour by talking about the Nobel Peace Prize award to President Obama. We had expected him to address reporters about this at 10:30, but the White House has now said that statement is put off till 11, so we won't be bringing that to you during this first hour of the news roundup. You know, Jerry, your paper, The Wall Street Journal, had a forecasting survey out yesterday on the economy. Not that encouraging. What did you find?
Well, business people are not yet convinced that the recession is really over. And there are some really good reasons for that. There are two in particular. One is that small businesses in particular are still finding it hard to get capital. They cannot get banks to lend them money the way they would like or they think they need. It's loosening up a little bit at the top of the business scale, but not so much in the middle and the bottom. And secondly, and I think people probably underestimate the effect of this, consumers are not yet comfortable going back into the marketplace. You know, there's One of the things that happened before this recession hit was there was a giant debt overhang that built up in American households. People went deeper into debt than they should have. They have now resolved they're going to pay down that debt. If you're paying down debt in your household, you're not buying in your household nearly as much. And businesses, I think, are worried, sensing that and worried about the effect of that. So a cautionary note, I think, in a generally improving economic picture.
Michael Fletcher, you know, the economy may be generally improving, but for the growing number of Americans who lack jobs, it doesn't feel that way. The president called House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Reid to the White House to talk about whether there's more that can be done to promote jobs. What are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about a number of things. One idea, for instance, is something the president talked about on the campaign trail was offering a tax credit to employers for bringing on new employees. And that was something that was offered up by the administration as part of the stimulus plan, but eventually scuttled by Congress. But now that idea is coming back. And there's also talk of extending kind of the safety net provisions of the stimulus package, which had kind of a one-year sunset. They want to extend unemployment benefits. And also there's some talk of extending federal help for out-of-work employees who buy COBRA health insurance. Mm. So there's a mix of ideas on the table. But the problem for the administration is they've come under such heavy fire from Republicans for what Republicans see as the lack of effectiveness of the stimulus plan, despite the verdict from many mainstream economists who said that the plan has been a key factor in stabilizing the economy. The problem is that stabilization has not extended to unemployment, which is expected to continue rising into next year, and putting real pressure on the administration, kind of from both sides. On one side, you know, people are worried about spending. On the other side, you know, particularly congressional Democrats are worried about jobs. They want to see those unemployment numbers go down before the midterm elections.
Well, Gene, do they have a point in arguing that what all the money the administration has spent already hasn't had the results that they want, and therefore they're talking about spending more?
Well, you know, right after they passed the stimulus, there were many economists who thought there needed to be a second one. And no matter what passes, it certainly is not going to be called stimulus, yes, too. But, you know, the White House is at an interesting juncture here because the stimulus package is just now sort of crossing the line into the infrastructure jobs that were supposed to create jobs. They're supposed to have, I believe it's later this month, their first report on job creation from the stimulus itself, and with more of those to come. And so we haven't really gotten a measure of the job creation from the stimulus, because the early part of the stimulus money wasn't about jobs, it was about stabilization. So they have that piece laying out there, a card to play. But, you know, the job credit, tax credit, they did want initially, and it got scuttled in large part because it's very hard to define, you know, what would be a job, what would count as a job, would temporary jobs be counted? How do you prove that an employer wasn't going to hire that person already but then claimed it was a stimulus hire or a tax credit hire? It's really a difficult thing to pass. And so I think that will remain a tricky option for them as they go forward as well.
I remember some concern at the time also that employers might just fire workers so they could then rehire them or rehire workers to replace them and get the tax credit. Well, Jerry Seib, tell us just briefly about the push that the president's going to make today. I suspect it's going to get less attention than he had hoped before he won the Nobel Prize this morning, but a push for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. What is it that the administration's proposing?
Well, this is part of the broader effort to rewrite the regulations that govern the financial services industry in the country in the wake of the Great Meltdown. A lot of that has to do with the way financial institutions are regulated themselves. But there was also an attempt to write into the legislation, a creation of a new agency that would specifically look out for consumers of financial products. In other words, make sure that people aren't being scammed by credit card companies, they're not being misled when they get a mortgage, that there's a place to go for that is specifically looking out for consumers, not the financial institutions themselves. The problem and the reason the president's going to talk about this is that this whole effort to rewrite the regulatory system has gotten bogged down in Congress a little bit. Republicans and Wall Street are not wild about a consumer protection agency, and it's in some peril of being dropped. In fact, the whole package is in some peril of not making it through, because as the economy slowly gets better, the sense of alarm fades and people don't remember as clearly why it was they set out to do this in the first place.
Well, let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to Keith in Washington, D.C. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Keith, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Good morning. Let's back up a little bit. You know, I want to comment on the Obama thing. I think it's a great thing for our country. I did vote for him. I think he's a wonderful guy. He has incredible hills and obstacles to get around and through. But, you know, I just want to make two comments. One is, I don't think the Republican Party has a leg to stand on, and especially Michael Steele. I, being an African American, I know Michael Steele is a complete idiot, and he's nothing but a pawn for that party. And he really needs to back up when he makes comments. And, you know, when he ran for office, he said the Republicans freed the slaves. Now, I took history just like everyone else. And, you know, I'll leave it for you guys to make comments on that. And second of all, I think it's an insult to our country and to the moms and fathers who've gotten that knock on the door about their kid being killed in a war, that someone who can control the outcome of this.
Oh, yeah. Kid, let me just ask you, you voted for Obama. You support him. Do you think he deserved the Peace Prize? Are you comfortable with that?
It's not a fair question to me or him or any of us, because he didn't ask for it. He didn't lobby for this. This was given to him by a third party. And when I should say an independent party, I don't think this was the time. And, you know, we went into this war just like we did Vietnam. We learned nothing from the history. We should have had 100,000 troops on the ground day one, and they should not leave until the problem is resolved. We are dragging our feet. Where everyone wants to be political and worried about this group of people, but they're not focusing on the task that needs to be done.
All right, Keith, thank you so much for your call. It'll be interesting to see in the next, in the coming days, what kind of reaction the prize award gets and whether there's a backlash to criticism like that of Michael Steele.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. Again, because so many people are kind of astonished this morning by the president winning this. And I can see it cutting both ways. I mean, there'll be some people who say that this continues kind of the Obama celebrity. You know, I think the critics out there. And others will talk about the hope that Obama inspires. And as Jerry pointed out earlier, the sense that Obama is actually looms larger as a world figure than maybe many Americans appreciate.
Let's go to Joseph. He's calling us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Joseph, you're on the air.
Thank you, Susan. I apologize for the quality of my line. I think it's because of the weather here, so I'll keep my comment brief. If you don't mind, I would like to change the subject to the Supreme Court action this week. I was pretty surprised that Justice Scalia denied the holiness of the cross when he acted himself aghast that anyone would suggest that the cross is automatically a religious symbol. I was wondering what the reaction from your panel would be on that. And do we know what religion he is? I mean, obviously he's a Christian because that's the only way he could universalize the applicability of the cross that way, and I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, Joseph, thanks for your call. He's talking about a case the court took up that deals with the separation of church and state. Jerry, Justice Scalia is a Catholic, is that right?
He's a Roman Catholic, that's correct. And the case has to do with the placement of a cross as a war memorial on a national property, a park grounds in the West. And an earlier ruling that said that was across the line of separation of church and state. A subsequent attempt to sort of carve out a little piece of that park to where the cross stood to make that a private piece of property, and a challenge now before the court about whether that also violates the separation of church and state.
And what were the signals from the discussion, the questions that the justices asked as they considered this case?
Well, it was interesting in that their questions focused a lot less on the broad question of the separation of church and state, and much more on whether the transfer of land from the federal government to the VFW, Congress transferred that piece of property in hopes of avoiding the very fight over separation of church and state, whether the transfer of that land was a legitimate and legal transaction. And so it looks as though the court is probably headed towards perhaps a narrow decision, much narrower than some of the those who wanted to see a big decision about separation of church and state. They were hoping for something like that would be transformational and maybe open the door to more religious displays. It sounds like the court's going down a smaller path.
First Monday in October, so the Supreme Court term got started. A lot of people were watching to see how the new justice, Sonia Sotomayor, would do. You know, it was surprising to some that she got so engaged, asked so many questions from the bench, Michael.
Well, indeed. And actually, she brought that reputation with her from the appeals court. She's Justice Sotomayor is a very active questioner and didn't shy away in her first days at oral argument at the Supreme Court. And some people are surprised at that. You have justices, and it's interesting how justices view this. I mean, some are very, like the tradition historically has been kind of not to have what they call a hot bench. You know, Justice Thomas is maybe the exemplar of that. He very rarely asks questions. But clearly, Sotomayor is from a different school. She believes in jumping in and asking many questions and, you know, making herself heard.
In the first hour, Sotomayor asked 36 questions. And in contrast, as you say, Justice Clarence Thomas has not asked a question for more than 3 years. So big contrast there. Let's talk to Alan. He's calling us from Emerald Isle, North Carolina.
Yeah,
Alan, thanks. You're on the air. Alan? Alan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, Alan, please go ahead. You know, I think our connection with Alan must be such that that we can't hear what he's saying. Let's talk for a few minutes about the case involving Charlie Rangel. He's the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee. Some people say that powerful is now part of the Ways and Means Committee's name because we always call it that. He's been undergoing an ethics investigation. And this week, the House Ethics Committee announced that it was expanding it to look at the fact that he has amended his financial disclosure form to show at least $600,000 in previously unreported assets. And there's been an effort this week, a renewed effort by Republicans, Gene, to force him to step aside from his committee chairmanship. How did that go?
Well, it was scuttled along party lines, and it was their third attempt to get some kind of resolution through to remove him from his chairmanship. And I don't know how much longer the Democrats may be able to hold off on doing something about the chairman. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said she is not going to do anything as long as the Ethics Committee is conducting its own investigation. And so that has been her position, and she's stood by it. It's a pretty stable place for her to be right now, especially since the Ethics Committee this week indicated that their investigation is robust, growing, and is substantive. There might have been some who argued that the waiting for an Ethics Committee investigation was just a scam because a lot of those, you know, end up being not serious investigations. This does now appear to be a serious investigation. And so her position that she doesn't want to do anything to interfere with that, it was reinforced and made a bit stronger this week. However, Rangel is in real trouble here.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Well, do you agree with that, Jerry Seib? Do you think that Charlie Rangel has been a fixture in the House for so many years? Do you think he is really in trouble here?
I think he's in trouble. I don't know what the outcome will be, and I suspect the Ethics Committee. I certainly agree with Gene that the fact the Ethics Committee made it clear this is a serious investigation buys everybody on the Democratic Party some time. I don't think it makes the outcome any easier for them to figure out, however. I suspect that one of the problems that they're wrestling with is the reality that they spent a lot of the campaign of 2008 talking about creating a new ethical climate in Washington, and this is going to be the centerpiece example that people will point to about whether they were serious about that or not. That's not good news for Chairman Rangel, I think.
Michael Fletcher, we've seen how seriously voters take charges of ethics against a party. It's been a big problem in the past. The House banking scandal comes to mind, for instance, as something that can really cost the party the next time voters have a chance to weigh in.
Right, and I think that's the big question facing Democrats. You here have the guy who chairs the tax writing committee accused of not paying taxes on an investment property he has in the Dominican Republic. He has three rent-stabilized apartments, you know, which are like gold in Manhattan. Take it from a New Yorker. And, and many people in Harlem, his constituents, were looking, I wish I had one of those. So, I mean, I think these are real questions for voters. And the thing that Chairman Rangel faces is that these, you know, alleged misdeeds are very understandable. They're not some convoluted schemes. I think people could kind of relate to what's alleged here.
Well, and I think that Speaker Pelosi will act, as Jerry said, given as much as they campaigned on this. But if you look at what she did with Jefferson, she did all that she could. She stripped him of his any committee status, of anything. They provided no defense around him, and they let him, face the consequences of his bribery charges. In Rangel's case, I think what she can't do anything now because there's no formal charge. If there is a formal finding by the Ethics Committee of violations, I would not be at all surprised to see the Speaker move at that point. And I think the Chairman Rangel probably knows that it will come at that time.
But, Chairman Rangel is a much bigger figure than Congressman Jefferson was. And I wonder what the reaction might be, for instance, within the Congressional Black Caucus to a move against him, Jerry.
That's a good question. I think the answer depends a lot on how this looks and feels when everything is laid out on the table by the Ethics Committee. It's one thing to have newspaper stories and Republican charges. It's another thing for the bipartisan Ethics Committee in the House to say, here's what we found, because that's a painful thing for them to do to one of their colleagues, and particularly when the Democratic Party is in the majority. So if it looks serious, if it feels substantive, when the Ethics Committee puts its stamp on its report, that will determine, I think, how everybody else reacts.
In the studio with me this hour for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup is Gene Cummings of Politico and Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal and Michael Fletcher of The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the terrorism plot that was disrupted. The Attorney General tells us it's the most serious plot since the 9/11 attacks. And we'll go to the phones, take your calls, and we'll read some of your emails. You can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. President Obama meets with top national security officials on Afghanistan. Pakistan voices displeasure over a proposed U.S. aid package. And international reaction to the Nobel Peace Prize Award. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're getting a lot of reaction by email to the Nobel Peace Prize going to President Obama. Linda in Laurel Fork, Virginia says, "The awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Barack Obama is a pretty clear indication of how alarmed the world was by Bush's go-it-alone policies." Terry from Rochester, New York writes us, "I'm astonished to hear Mr. Steele words, that's a reference to the Republican chairman criticizing Barack Obama. And Terry goes on, "His graceless remarks epitomize the mud pit that American politics have become." And here's one more from Bill, who writes us from Dallas. He says, "I support him and excited by Obama's presidency, but I think we are so starved for heroes that we are now praising them in advance of their righteous acts." Well, let's go back to the phones and listen to some of our listeners. Chad is calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Chad, you're on the air.
I'd like to just take us back to the comments that were made around the Consumer Protectionism Agency being formed. And I think perhaps an analogy creates the sense that I seem to get from what's happening in government today. You know, I feel like we're, you know, whether it's the Supreme Court or this action that would be created by the Obama administration, I feel like we're in a house that has a leaky roof, and we're running around with pails trying to catch the water where it's leaking. And in fact, what we need is a new roof. And I don't know exactly, I don't pretend to know what exactly that would look like, but there's just too many rules. We can't even keep up with all the different rules that have been created.
All right, Chad, thanks for your call. Gene.
Well, I think there are more rules on the way. That's the way of Washington. The Consumer Protection Agency is very controversial, it's true, and business is fighting back against it. But I do think that at least certainly in the House, Chairman Barney Frank has made it clear some version of that is coming out of the House. And I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on the Senate to also back some form of it, especially since Chairman Dodd is in such political trouble right now. And one path that I believe he and his advisors think is a way out of that trouble is to show that he's going to come down hard on the banks and on behalf of consumers, and to show that he is independent of the financial sector, which has been for a long time one of his chief financial backers.
We heard from the Attorney General this week, Eric Holder, about the alleged terror plot that was disrupted in New York. He called it the most serious, or one of the most serious, since the 9/11 attacks. Tell us about it, Michael.
Yeah, well, there was a 24-year-old Afghan immigrant who authorities had been tracking from Colorado. He'd been buying bomb-making material, allegedly, and drove from Colorado to New York around the time of the UN General Assembly meetings there. Authorities tracked his movements, and it's interesting, and ended up arresting him when he actually flew back to Colorado when he sensed he was being followed. But the Obama administration has pointed to this case to sort of make the point that, you know, our anti-terror policies work. They've sort of portrayed the president as being, you know, deeply engaged on this issue. They claim that this case was mentioned to him during his daily briefings, and he kind of followed this, you know, for days and days on end. And they're making the point to push back against some of the criticism from former Vice President Cheney and others that some of the jettisoned policies aren't necessary, you know, to keep the country safe.
And yet we have an email from Robert who asks us, in reference to the thwarted terrorist plot, he says, quote, it would be interesting to look into how much wiretapping and provisions of the Patriot Act helped in bringing them to justice, laws the Democrats find anathema and have campaigned against. Do we know the answer to Robert's question? To what role did these policies help investigators?
Only to some extent in this case, because it's only beginning its path through the court system. Interestingly, though, this week the Democratic-controlled Judiciary Committee approved an extension of three parts of the Patriot Act that were about to expire, which is still controversial in the House and has become the vehicle by which lots of these civil liberties questions are going to be raised again. But I think that what the law enforcement community has going for it in that regard is that there's not only this case, there was a case in Springfield, Illinois, a case in Dallas, Texas, a case in North Carolina, all of which were apparently unconnected but recent attempts of varying degrees of seriousness by people to think about committing terrorist acts in this country. And that's going to strengthen the resolve of people who think there ought to be a Patriot Act full bore.
We know that one of the reasons the federal officials got so interested or were so concerned was that this guy seemed to actually know how to make a bomb. Do we know if bombs were actually made?
We don't know for sure. We know that they found evidence that he had been cooking up some equipment for a bomb and in a hotel. They've told us that much. But we don't know if he succeeded. In fact, they may believe that he didn't succeed in doing it. But they did find him with bomb-making instructions in his car. But one of the things the White House is pointing to here is as a triumph, and I didn't get the sense they were doing it as a way of, like, a rebuke to the Bush administration, but I think they meant it as progress for the intelligence community, and that was that the CIA and the FBI really did work collaboratively here to capture and foil this plot, assuming it was in play. And, of course, after 9/11, there were so many reports of missed opportunities. And so this was heralded by the president as evidence that the intelligence community has come a long way, and because of that, we are safer.
We had action in the House this week making anti-gay violence a federal hate crime, including that among factors such as a victim's race or religion or national origin, as making an attack attack as possibly being classified as a hate crime with additional penalties. Is this likely to become law, do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I think so, because it's attached to a defense appropriations bill. But many Republicans still oppose this, and people who oppose these kinds of laws tend to say, you know, violence is a crime, period. You know, if a gay person's attacked, let's prosecute the assault. We don't have to sort of set aside these categories. So that I think that basic divide still remains.
You know, it was attached to a $681 billion military policy bill. It doesn't seem like military policy. Why is it attached to that bill, Gene?
Well, they find all sorts of parliamentary reasons for attaching it. But one of the best reasons to stick it on that bill was because that bill had to pass and was sure to pass. And so it was a sure way of moving the legislation along. It's been lingering out there for about 8 years, and the Democrats really want to get that bill passed.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Mary. She's calling us from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is this. Has any discussion been given to expanding the federal government's role in lending? I've been a mortgage lender for 25 years, a good one. I didn't do any bad loans. I really did. And it seems to me we are now being crushed with new regulations, which almost prevent us from doing our jobs. Has anybody talked about expanding FHA or just creating a new office of lending and let the federal government run the lending? There's so much money to be made from it. I just feel like they can almost do a better job, and it's so critical to the economy. And then I have a comment about...
Now, Mary, let me just stop you there and let me ask you from your view. We've talked earlier in this hour about the economy picking up, jobs not so much. How does it look from your position as a mortgage lender on how the economy is doing right now?
I don't want to say on the air what I feel. People are tired of hearing my comments because I've been pretty... I have very definite views on this. I think this is a big pit that we're in. It's going to take quite a long time to dig ourselves out. I liken it to a glass being full. If we have, everyone in America has borrowed and borrowed and borrowed, the glass is now full. The average loan term is 30 years. You all can probably figure from that what I think.
All right, Mary, thanks for your call. Is there talk about expanding the federal role in getting money for mortgages?
Well, the federal role has been expanded considerably in getting mortgage money out, but it's not taken the form, and I don't think will take the form, of the federal government directly making mortgage loans. What the administration has tried to do, well, it's tried to do several things. One of them has been to expand FHA programs. Another one has been to get money directly into the hands of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are the big quasi-governmental agencies. They're now really governmental agencies that buy mortgages from mortgage lenders so that they will in turn then have more cash to make more mortgages. I think those are the principal routes by which the government is trying to get money out into the mortgage market, in addition to helping people who need to refinance existing mortgages. If that works, that also has the effect of getting more money into the market because it takes the spectrum of foreclosure away from mortgage companies that don't want to hold on to houses that are going nowhere.
We heard a big push from the Obama administration this week for those swine flu vaccinations. Why are they focused on this so much, Michael?
Well, there's a lot of fear out there. Despite fear of the swine flu, a lot of people are even more fearful of the vaccinations themselves. There have been surveys out there showing that a third of parents wouldn't allow their children to receive this vaccination. So administration officials are really trying to get out there and say that, indeed, this thing is safe, and having children vaccinated is probably the most important link in the chain because they become sort of the carriers of this virus.
Well, I, for one, think it would be helpful if they would come up with some kind of clear way of communicating what is going on with flu shots this year, because we have the regular flu shot, we have the H1N1 flu shot, we have the nasal thing going on. You could do two of them together. You can't do two of the others together. And I just think if they could come up with some clear way to instruct people on how to proceed, it would be very helpful. And I don't think they've done that yet.
You know, we've seen in surveys surprising resistance by parents to having their children vaccinated. There was one survey that showed just 37% of parents said they were very likely to give permission to have their children vaccinated. Why do you think, Jerry?
It's a bit of a mystery. I think people say to themselves, well, you know, my child will live through the flu, but I'm not going to take that one in a million chance that there's a sort of very negative reaction to the vaccination. We'll survive flu. We would never survive that. It is a surprise to me, though, the extent to which that's been a problem. I didn't expect it.
Yeah, me either. Let's go to Terry. He's calling us from Columbus, Ohio. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to make a statement that I was wondering if you could maybe comment on the unemployment figures in every state. In my 52 years of living and following them, this is the first time that they're not going to be accurate, and they won't resolve from it. But the unemployment figures are given that if your unemployment runs out, if your benefit runs out to most members in any state, they consider you back in the workforce. And so this is the first time that our economy actually isn't going to come back from that. And so to me, the figures aren't accurately given.
Now, Terry, that's news to me. Gene, is that your understanding?
Well, there are economists who do alternative calculations that say, you know, the unemployment rate is 9.8%. But if you also include all the people who have given up, then who've given up looking, then it's much higher. So there, and that number can be well over 10.
But is that different from the way it was calculated before?
No, I think that there's always been, you know, this sort of alternative way of looking at the unemployment rate. But I think one of the hard things with this recession and recovery is that we were in a bubble, the bubble burst. And now we have to get down to the size of what is an appropriate economy for us. And that invariably means that it will be smaller because it had ballooned out into something that wasn't sustainable.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Jerry, do you have concerns, as does our caller Terry, about whether the unemployment numbers are really reflecting what's happening in states?
Well, they're reflecting what's going on in states to the extent that they're a good trend line indicator. Are they totally accurate down to the last job seeker out there? No, they're not. And as Gene suggests, they never really have been. You know, one of the things that happens is if your unemployment benefits run out, you stop showing up at the unemployment benefit office filing them, then you drop off the radar screen. Congress, I think, as Michael indicated, is likely to extend those benefits. That's not likely to happen. I also think there's going to be an attempt in Congress to try to get some more money out to the states, because states are going to be in a terrible bind next year because they are lagging indicators in recession. Their budgets are going to be a wreck. They're going to start laying off people. They're going to not let contracts. And by the way, they're going to be tempted to raise taxes at the state level, which is not what you want when you're trying to recover. So one of the ways I think that this job loss out in the states is going to be combated is to find ways from Congress, from Washington, to get money to the states.
All right, let's go to David. He's calling us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, David.
Hello.
Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. Concerns of the bankers and their refusal to help small businesses with the loans.
All right. Go ahead.
It's really, I just don't understand why the banks are doing this. Isn't there something that can be done to force the banks to help low business, small businesses, et cetera, and help this economy move forward in a positive way?
All right, David, thanks for your call. Boy, we know that small businesses have really been hit by this recession.
Well, that is emerging as a big problem. That's where the money isn't flowing. The reasons are pretty clear. Banks are not sure how much the assets they have in the books are worth, so they've pulled back. The pullback hurts small business people. There are people in the Obama administration, Treasury Department, who are spending a lot of time working on exactly this problem. They're going to get some more money to the Small Business Administration to make loans, for one thing. And there's also a lot of job bonuses. running. The administration is going out and telling banks, we expect you to start loaning, particularly to small business people, because you came to us for help, you got it, now it's your turn.
Michael, we talked earlier in this hour about Democrats being divided on some of the health care bill provisions, but we saw this week the White House able to roll out support from some big-name Republicans on behalf of a health care bill.
Yes, we did. But interestingly, none of them were members of Congress. You know, you have Governor Schwarzenegger and others who've actually voiced support in the past, you know, coming out at the urging of the White House to say they support this. And the White House is, I think, trying to create this sense of momentum, you know, for the finance bill. But I think the key question is, like, what about the voting members here?
You know? Well, you make a good point. Although these are some, as you say, some big names. Tommy Thompson, who was in George W. Bush's cabinet, Schwarzenegger, Bill Frist, Bob Dole, two prominent former senators.
I think that's largely for public consumption to, you know, the bipartisanship was something that President Obama talked a whole lot about. They've in some ways are trying to redefine it or at least create some illusion of it. And, you know, the Republicans on Capitol Hill have staked out their position, but this is the White House trying to at least demonstrate that it does have some Republican support out in the country.
Gene Cummings of Politico, Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal, and Michael Fletcher for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.